So thank you for coming. What I'd like to talk to you about tonight are the precepts. Precepts are at the center of Buddhist practice, and particularly at the center of Zen practice. Precepts are guidelines for us. They're guidelines for this path, the path that we are all on, each one of us is on. Each one of us is traveling this path that's never been traveled before, but with guidelines left by others, signposts left by others. And I want to begin with a little bit of background to the precepts. The Buddha resisted rules. And there's always been factions in Buddhist sanghas, people who like rules and people who don't like rules. And the issue has come up in many ways. In the beginning, there were 227 precepts for monks and 311 for nuns. Rules have always been a question. You know, I think about even in the current era, in the beginning of Tassajara, the training monastery, part of this lineage, there was a debate. And the debate was some people wanted more rules, some people wanted rules, there were no rules really, and some people didn't want rules. And there were a lot of people there who had come out of very rule-rich environments in schools, churches, and really people who were very turned off to rules. And then there was Suzuki Roshi, who was not so interested in starting with a lot of rules. And so that dynamic, that tension between rules and no rules was present even in the 60s when Tassajara was founded. And I'll just relate to you that they were in a meeting. The story goes, I wasn't there. I came a little bit later. But the meeting, there was a meeting and a number of students were sort of pushing Suzuki Roshi. We need rules. We need rules. You know, people aren't behaving properly. There should be requirements. And Suzuki Roshi sort of looked up and he looked to the back of the room. He had been resisting and he said, see that broom against the back wall? It's turned with the bristles down. The first rule of Tassajara is brooms should be turned with the bristles up so they don't get bent when they're not being used. And that was the first rule. That was the first rule of Tassajara. So that's the way he dealt with the issue of rules. But in Buddhism originally, in the schools of the elders, otherwise known as Theravadan Buddhism, there were five precepts. And the precepts began as monastic rules. And they were mostly concerned with restraint, with restraining people, keeping people from doing things that would harm others or harm themselves. And the list that you have in front of you, if you look at it, you'll see the clear mind, what's called the clear mind precepts. The first, toward the bottom, middle of the page, the first five in the list, and not in this form, which I'll talk about in a moment, but they were these were the beginning rules. You know, don't kill, don't steal, no sex, don't lie, and don't intoxicate. And what happened with Buddhism, and has continued to happen with Buddhism, is as it's moved from continent to continent and country to country and culture to culture, that Buddhism has changed. And it's changed, I think, in good ways. What I mean by good is not good as in good and bad, but in ways that are more adapted to the cultures where it moved to. So when Buddhism moved to China from India, where it was originally formed, it mixed strongly with Taoism, and lay practice, not just monastic practice, became much more important. Some of this was due to social conditions, whereas in India, Buddhist monasteries, monks were prohibited from working. They were not allowed to work. It was against the rules. They weren't allowed to handle money. They weren't allowed to work. But when Buddhism, by the 7th century in China, when monasteries were being established in the mountains, they had no choice but to work. There was no other way for them to get their food. So they began to work the soil. They began to organize themselves around growing crops. And the fourth patriarch, Cao Xin, was the one who really led that mission to establish monasteries on a self-supporting basis. I'm sure you've all heard the words no work, no food, right? Which became the motto of monasteries when people would say, well, I'm a monk, why do I have to work? Well, no work, no food. So the five precepts, the five original precepts that came from India were added to as the community of Buddhists widened and extended to lay people. And the current version that you have in front of you, these are called the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. Bodhisattva, of course, is a word, Pali, that means someone who's dedicated to helping other people. So these are the precepts that we use here today, and they weren't in this form until roughly in this form till the 13th century, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The person who probably had more to do with formulating this system of thought and practice, Dogen, in the 13th century, he put this list together, and he had studied in China, so when he came back to Japan from China and organized a monastery, the first Zen monastery in Japan, this was the list that he came up with. The version that you have in front of you is not exactly the list that he actually made. The list this list was put together by a man named Koben Chino, who was a Roshi, a teacher. He's now deceased. In Santa Cruz, he came here originally to help with other congregations and then became a teacher on his own. And then he put together, and if you'll notice, if you sort of glance at these, you'll see that they're not really so much about restraint as they are about somehow nurturing life, somehow giving life some vividness. This version was basically from Koben Chino and then added to and tweaked a little bit by Norman Fisher. So that's the version. And there are different versions out there. So this is not the only version. I think this is a good version. It's a version that affirms life and not just tells you what you shouldn't do. One point that needs to be made about the precepts is that when the precepts first came from India, the first, if you notice on the page, the pure precepts, which are the second group, there are three of them, this version is a later version. So the first pure precepts were, the first one was always, I vow to do good, was the first one. And the second one was, I vow to avoid evil. Okay, they're in different words here, but that's basically the essence of it. In Theravadan Buddhism, and originally Buddhism, the third precept was to clear your mind. So they went something like this. Refrain from evil, practice all that is good, and purify your mind. And what happened to Buddhism, and a major change in Buddhism when it moved from India to China, is that concern with clearing your mind got replaced. And what it got replaced by is the one that's on this page, which is the third one, was I vow to act with others always in mind, or I vow to basically, the way that it came down was I vow not to be liberated, not to reach nirvana until everyone reaches nirvana. What I'm here in this world to do is not just to save myself, not just to be in the monastery and take care of myself, but in the second version of Buddhism as we know it, which emerged in China, the emphasis was, and this is what the teaching of this group comes out of, the lineage of the San Francisco Zen Center, is I vow not to be liberated until everyone is liberated. I vow to be of assistance to everyone in different ways. So the emphasis was then on compassion. Compassion became the big the motivating factor in Buddhism rather than just reaching nirvana for you, you the monk, but compassion toward all people. So what happened in Mahayana Buddhism, the second big phase of Buddhism, is that the emphasis really shifted from me to everyone. And I'll read you just I think it's a good example. It's a sort of famous case, case 54 from the Book of Serenity. It's very short. And it sort of emphasizes this. And it's, you know, this is a koan. And koans are discussions between, usually between two monks, and one of them is trying to illustrate something for the other one, and sometimes they're more clear or less clear, but this one I think is pretty clear. And the case goes, the main case, the koan, is, "Attention," Ungan asks Dojo, "what does the great compassionate bodhisattva do when she uses her manifold hands and eyes?" The Avalokiteshvara, the great compassionate bodhisattva, is thought to have a hand, thought to have an eye in each hand, and thought to have 1,000 hands. You probably have seen statues like that. "What does the great compassionate bodhisattva do when she uses her manifold hands and eyes?" Dogo said. "It's like a man who reaches behind him at night to search for his pillow." In other words, it's something that you just do naturally. You don't even think about it. Ungan said, "I understand," Dogo said. "What do you understand?" Ungan said. And then the answer was, "All over the body are hands and eyes to understand and hear the suffering of the world." Dogo said, "You've really said it. You got it, but only 80%. And Ungan said, "Elder brother, how about you?" Dogo said, "It's not 80, it's not just hands and it's not just eyes in the hands, but the whole body is hands and eyes to hear the suffering of the world." So you see the shift. This is a really good example of the shift that occurred toward compassion as the centerpiece of the kind of Buddhism that Zen is and the kind of Buddhism we practice. So what's the place of the precepts in our lives? Well, they're sort of like, people generally tend to think of them, they're sort of like a commandment, maybe like the Ten Commandments that we all grew up with. I grew up with the Ten Commandments on the wall of the living room. We never looked at them, but they were there. But what the precepts do, and I think the commandments as well, is they address our behavior. And what the precepts try to do is they help us to settle in our lives. And they're different from the commandments in that the commandments, a commandment is more of a declaration of what you should do. Do this. Don't do that. Whereas the precepts are more of a, begins more with your experience, with our experience, and is based on our experience. And it's not something that's set in stone that you better do this or you're bad. For example, the commandment, do not kill, was probably originally, it meant just that. Before there was a municipal sheriff or a policeman, it meant something, it meant exactly, do not kill. Whereas today, it's very different. It's come, in the precepts anyway, it's come to have a different meaning. So the precepts are not so much a declaration from on high, but it gives us a direction that we can adhere to or violate. Precepts put the question to us, and they have, and what you find is when you begin to look at them, for example, the issue of killing, okay, do not kill. Well, it sounds like a simple statement, do not kill, but in fact, there are many varieties of killing, right? Some people think that it's in the natural order to eat meat, so animals have to be killed to derive the meat. I remember one morning a monk came in, Jim, you may have been there, that a monk came in from the fields at Green Gulch Farm, and he said, "I was out mowing the grass this morning, and I killed thousands of beings. I killed caterpillars. I killed ants. I ran over them with the tractor." He said, "I didn't try to do any of it, but that's what happened." Right? So, do not kill is it's more complicated. And what the precepts do is they put it back to you. It is, what is your experience? What please examine this and look and see into the precept. What is it about it? How do you interpret this in your life? And to me, if you look at the first one on the clear mind precepts on the sheet that was passed out, not to kill but to nurture life. Not to kill but to nurture life. What an amazing thing it is to nurture life, to be able to say to yourself that I value my life, that my life is something that is of extreme importance to me. And I think that what happens is when people begin to realize that this life is not something that's given to us, that it's something it's not something that we have a right to, so to speak, that it's something that that a lot of people don't value their lives. That's what I'm trying to say. That it's just sort of given to them and it's not something that they ever think of as of particular value. So that what this is saying is that not to kill but to nurture life, to try to encourage people to value their lives, to value your own life. You know, it's an interesting aside, but just as a little side note, that the whole abortion issue sort of comes into this, because the people who are against abortion usually justify it as saying, well, it's a commandment. It's not up to me. I'm not saying there shouldn't be abortion, but it's like, you know, it's a commandment. It's part of the Ten Commandments. Whereas, and I don't think you'll find, and I'm not trying to say I'm not trying to make a judgment here about right or wrong, but I'm trying to point out how people come to the opinion they have about abortion. And what, in Buddhism, it's, the precept is don't kill, but how you interpret that is based on what you think and what you experience and what for you goes to the center of your life. So it's not taken literally. You try to adhere to it, but Buddhists ask the question, well, what is killing? What is killing? So in a world of moral ambiguity, the precepts offer us a guide to ethical living. And if you do a fair amount of meditation, what you find is that, I found that if you have a lot of sort of moral issues hanging around your life, should I do this, should I not do this, is this right, is this, you know, something that's wrong, according to my terms, that it's very hard to meditate because these issues are constantly coming up. And what the precepts do is they offer us a guide how to get along with people and how to get along with ourselves. Katagiri Roshi said, well, the precepts are a key to a peaceful life. So what the precepts do is they give us guidelines so that the moral ambiguities in our lives get settled by us, but in a way that affects our behavior and affects our attitudes. It allows us to go deeper in meditation and allows us to stabilize our mind and our heart. It provides an avenue toward calmness and a settling of what should I do. It grounds us beyond our conduct and attitudes even. As stated in the Jukai ceremony, which some of you have Roksu, so if you have a Roksu, you've been through the Jukai ceremony, and it says, and one of the things that's asked of people in the Jukai ceremony is, Jukai ceremony, of course, is taking the precepts in a public domain. So you're basically, when you study the precepts, and you sew a Roksu, and then you go through a ceremony where you receive the precepts, the question it's asked you of you in the ceremony is, after you become a Buddha or a bodhisattva, will you still follow the precepts? I always, whenever I hear that question, it always sort of gives me the chills, you know, because it's like, what? I'm going to become a Buddha? And I have to do these things? I have to think about what I do? I can't just blow off at people or just, you know, get angry whenever I want to? So what the precepts do is they guide us toward a beautiful life. But the big question is, how do we use the precepts? They help you, as one monk said, they're like a trellis that you grow up strong next to, and then you stand on your own. It allows the practice to continue and to grow. The precepts allow us to relax in a way that perhaps we haven't relaxed before. Dogen tells us that when we live the precepts, they cannot be kept, because he's dealing in a much bigger sphere. There are three ways to interpret the precepts. There's the literal way. I don't want to go into this too much, but I feel like I need to mention it. But there's the literal way, word for word, and then there's a compassionate way. For example, the compassionate way, well, maybe you don't tell the truth. If someone comes to the door with a gun and wants to kill someone in the house, you say, well, they're not here. So you've lied, but you've lied in the interest of compassion. So what Dogen tells us, and then the third way to interpret the precepts is what's called the absolute. But Dogen tells us that living the precepts, they cannot be kept. And he's referring to two things. One of the things he's referring to is the fact that it's assumed that we're all going to make mistakes. That even after you've taken the precepts and you said publicly, I'm going to follow the precepts, I'm going to try to live my life according to this list, that you're going to make mistakes. Things are going to happen. None of us are perfect. So that mistakes are part of the paradigm and they're expected. But in the realm of the absolute, in the bigger picture, Dogen says that the precepts cannot really be broken, because they're non-dual. There's a level of emptiness where nothing, we can't break the precepts. Nothing we can do can break the precepts. So the precepts are call on you to be skillful, creative, in how you exercise them in your life. But they also call upon you to be careful, to try to exercise them carefully, and to keep them in focus. When Suzuki Roshi said, he said, when you are you, Zen is Zen. And so what he was trying to say is that everyone will express the precepts differently. Everyone, the precepts, in other words, will all take away from the precepts a different meaning and a different intention. And the key to what kind of intention we have is our awareness. How are we doing? What is the effect of what we're doing? So our practice is not limited to just the meditation hall, but is in the world. So I thought I'd maybe just try to give a few examples of interpreting the precepts to sort of illustrate what I'm trying to get at. So as I said, the first one, if you look at it, not to kill, but to nurture life. So you're realizing in going into this precept that we each have the capacity to nurture life for ourselves and to nurture life for others, to encourage people, to encourage interest, to encourage involvement, to encourage compassion. When we express compassion, we encourage someone else to be compassionate. And it's catchy. And we each have the ability to express, to nurture life. And how we do it is our own personal expression and needs to be uncovered and opened, because it's in each one of us already. The second one, not to steal, but to receive what is offered as a gift. Well, you know, there's kind of an inside joke in that one. Because in you know, one of the big points of Zen is that you've got everything you need and this is not a self-improvement project. Zen is not a way for you to become better. You don't need to gain anything. So in Zen, the joke is that to steal, people if you look in the text, sometimes you'll see reference to a thief. And a thief is usually someone who only comes to the practice because they want more. They want to be better. Right? So, and when you really begin to settle into the practice, you realize the point is not to be better. The point is to be who you are right now. And being better is not a goal that you're ever going to get to the end of. Because then it'll be better after better. The third precept, not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships. Well, you know, what an amazing thing it is here today that we, you know, the people of any sexual persuasion, that the emphasis, what I think what this is saying is, the emphasis is on being satisfied, somehow finding your way to find meaning, find intimacy, and that you don't have to fake it. You don't have to pretend caring when that in fact that we can all express our sexuality in an honest way. Not to lie, but to be truthful. Well, I don't know. The precepts in the biggest sense would say that it's impossible to lie. Dogen would say it's impossible to lie, because when you lie, you're telling your truth. You know, in other words, someone lying and you say, well, I know that person is lying, but in fact, they're lying in some small sense, but in the big sense, they're telling what they believe to be true, and even so they're expressing something about the lack of truth in what they're saying. And I'll take a look at the last one, the fifth one, not to intoxicate. Well, I think what this points out to us, not to intoxicate with substances or doctrines, but to promote clarity and awareness. I always like that one, because I feel like what it points out is that substances and, you know, drugs, alcohol are not the only way that people are intoxicated, that we can be intoxicated with doctrines. You can be intoxicated with Buddhism in a way that's not healthy. And Buddhism is not exempt from this precept. Usually, in Buddhism, there's a built-in self-correction. So if you sit seriously and sit long enough, you will not be intoxicated with Buddhism, I'll guarantee you. You'll be tired. what this one points out is the many ways that we can intoxicate and how we need to resist, you know, for example, the whole proclamation in the fifth one, not to intoxicate with substances or doctrines, that the whole notion of be like me, which, you know, is something we all in some way, especially with people we love, people close to us who we want to do something nice for, and how that's not always a creative and not always a helpful idea. So what I'm trying to convey is that there's a lot of flexibility in how we look at the precepts. It's very important that we not set up standards on our own. But at the same time, I encourage you in looking at the precepts and studying the precepts, which if you haven't already, I'm sure you will, to think about how you can exercise the precepts in your life creatively and beautifully. And I'm going to read you one paragraph from this. This is a new book by Norman Fisher, The World Could Be Otherwise. And he talks about the precepts. He talks about the precepts he is ethical conduct. He says, in Buddhism, the practice of ethical conduct is an integral element in a path designed to bring understanding and compassion to human beings. Good conduct is not commanded. It is urged as an essential path, essential to the path toward happiness and liberation. So Buddhist ethics tend to be flexible. And since, as with the other bodhisattva perfections, the perfection of ethical conduct is also pervaded by the perfection of understanding, which recognizes the emptiness of everything. That's what I was saying, the bigger sphere. Ethical conduct is empty of ethical conduct. You can't break the rules. In the bodhisattva path, ethical conduct is a wider and more open question, one with more dimensionality than unchanging norms and rules could do justice to. So, so that's pretty much what I wanted to say about the precepts. Do we have more time, or how are we doing?
I don't have a
do you want to do an exercise?
Sure.
Okay, so why don't we do this? Let's divide up into groups of three, and just three people face each other. So let's go ahead and do that, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to ask you to do. A bell?
Anyone want to report? I'll say it.
Please.
My name is Raphael. And I didn't realize to the extent until this moment how special the precept is that I vow to act with others in mind, always have others in mind. And it includes all the precepts at the expense of myself, because I'm not putting myself ahead of anyone or anything. And I didn't realize how special it was until now. I don't know if these two gentlemen had a strong influence on me, but it certainly impressed upon me in such a way that when I wake up in the morning, to have this precept at the forefront of my third eye, my mind's eye, and even when I lie down and go to sleep. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Daniel. The version, I don't know how many versions there are of this, but the one on not to harbor anger, but to forgive, the version that I'm familiar with is, I vow not to be angry. The version that I'm familiar with is, I vow not to be angry. So this one's interesting because it says, I vow not to harbor anger. So it's a slightly different word choice. So it's like almost...
Very important difference.
Sorry?
Very important difference.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying it's okay to be angry, just don't harbor it. And I think if you've been meditating long enough, you'll kind of have a taste of anger a little bit.
You kind of?
You get a taste of anger if you've been meditating long enough, I think.
Yeah, I think what it's doing is it's realizing that we all get angry.
Right.
It's not something that it's going to happen, whether we express it or not. The problem is when you begin to express anger, it can often be destructive. And so, but the precept is don't harbor anger. You know, don't hold a grudge. Because the grudge, you know, the Buddha said getting angry with someone is like trying to pick up hot coals and throw them at someone and think that you're not going to be burned.
Did you take
I did. Did I put it back on?
So any other comments?
Yes, I have one. My name is Clem. What I found during our discussion, or at least what I observed, is it seems that our view of the precepts depends on our own preferences, or if you will, what expectations we have. You know, we talk about things like how we react to drivers that we perceive do so badly, or
Can you hear back there?
No.
I dislike the microphone, which is a preference of mine.
If you can't hear, put up your hand.
Yeah, like I said, I think how we view the precepts, and it depends on our expectations of both ourselves and others, is what I was hearing during the conversation. And how we choose to interpret them is based on that.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I continue to be really interested in the way how every precept is contained in every precept.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I vow not to kill, but to nurture life is embedded in I vow not to lie. It's embedded in not intoxicating. It's embedded in all of them. So we can examine them individually, but know that it's a really circular observation and study.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, thank you. I think we're out of time, right?
I don't have a watch.
Still?
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, thank you. So please keep these if you like. And, work with the precepts. You know, think of when you work with the precepts, think of doing it in your own creative way. With the principles of not harming, compassion, kindness, first compassion toward yourself, and compassion toward others. But think of it as creating something, as painting a beautiful picture or a beautiful sculpture in your life. And I think what you'll find is as the precepts begin to affect your behavior, that you'll find that other people respond to you, even though they may not know the precepts, that they'll respond to you in like kind. So, thank you.